Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. This week we are sharing some short stories by Duluth author Connie Ellis. She was the author of The Ice Dancer, the novel recently shared on Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll hear two stories, the first one called Noodles, a story about a dog, and takes place under the moon in an ordinary backyard. And that'll be followed by The Stove, which takes place in the woods outside of Northome, Minnesota, where two girls share an almost Hans Christian Andersen adventure with a wood-burning stove. First, Noodles.
Noodles. It was a dark, moonless night, and Joe was drinking a glass of cheap beer. He was concentrating on the last of the beer at the bottom of his glass, noting how it was the color of the moon, but of course there was no moon in the bar, only the moon of his imagination. A cheap beer moon. "Hey, Joe, you look nuts. You okay?" "Just looking in my beer." "Yeah, well, see you then. Night." "Closing time, Joe." "Yep, all done. On my way." "I can walk. I can walk. I've walked home way worse than this. The trick is to follow the crack on the floor that leads to the door. One step at a time. There we go. Whoops. Little step there. Okay, steady now. Compose yourself, like Rose says. Imagine you're a prince, a royal prince, a poet even. Dylan Thomas, she calls me. Says someday, I'll write great poetry. The moon cries and makes sad beer. All night it cries, crying, crying, crying. Joe sings softly and step by step walks down the sidewalk, a shadow in the night. His black curly head a dark wobbling cloud above the hedges of the sleeping town of Blue Harbor Bay. He misses the turn off to his house and circles the quiet hedge-lined block until he arrives at his house. Now the house with the red door. Last week the house with the blue door. Informally, the house with the lavender door, which is as far back as he remembers, because before lavender they had an ordinary door. Joe heads to the backyard, to the corner where Noodles is buried under the big yellow ash. He sits down on his coffee rock and begins to sing. "Oh, Danny boy, the lights are glowing. From glen to glen, upon the many rocks." He doesn't notice Rose come out the back door in her brown plaid bathrobe and is startled at the sound of the lawn chair snapping open. "Give a dog a bone," he hums, as she settles into the raggedy lawn chair beside his rock, its green plastic straps hanging down like banana leaves. "Let me light it tonight," he says, and she hands him the blue cylindrical candle with a haloed portrait of Mary in blue and pink embedded in the wax. Joe centers the candle on the old driftwood board above the dog's grave and lights it with a wooden match. The candlelight glows above the pink petals of a rosebud on the ceremonial board and backlights an old marrow bone and a wilted daisy. "Almost 3 months, and it'll be a year she's been gone," Rose says. "Yep." "Mr. Peabody's lights come on. You'd better get another chair." Joe and Rose sit in silence, enjoying the calm of the candlelight. Joe sighs loudly, knowing the peace will end as soon as Mr. Peabody joins them. He gets up to find the extra chair as Mr. Peabody shuffles through the gate between their backyards. "Hi, Joe, Rose. I couldn't sleep." Mr. Peabody zips up his leather jacket over his flannel pajamas and huddles himself into his chair. He takes a withered carrot out of his pocket to set beside the wilted daisy. "Best dog I ever knew," Mr. Peabody says. "You know, Rose, I kind of think of him as my wife, being as he's right here and the wife's out at the cemetery. Noodles is kind of a representation of the dead, don't you think?" "It's Noodles down there," Joe says. "That's Noodles' body down there." "He's Noodles, and he's everybody," Rose adds. "Everyone who's gone before. He can be your wife, Mr. Peabody, just like always. That's perfectly fine." Thank you, Rose. They sit quietly under the tree, contemplating the candlelight and their own thoughts, and enjoying the peace of the night under the stars, vaguely aware of how nice it is to be alive on such a calm summer's night. One lone cricket chants in the backyard, accompanied by a chorus of frogs from the nearby bay, four blocks down Marine Drive. I like my wife a lot better dead, Mr. Peabody says. That's all right, isn't it, Rose? Sure, it is. We know what you mean, and it's just fine. Here in the night, we can say whatever we want, and it's all right. You shouldn't say things like that during the day, though. You know that, don't you, Mr. Peabody? Oh, yes, I know all right. Mrs. Jones, she'd put me straight away. She's just waiting on me, waiting to put me in the poorhouse. No way, I won't go. I don't tell her a thing, except I'm fine, I'm healthy, I sleep great. Mr. Peabody wiggles his toes, recalling the unexpected burst of inspired cleaning energy when he shined up his kitchen. If she had come 2 days earlier. I made a portrait of Mrs. Peabody on the kitchen countertop. Tuesday I did that. I used beans mostly, leftover beans, poured them right out of the pan onto the red linoleum countertop. It was the olives that got me started, green like her eyes, with that little pimento glint, you know. Just came to me like a revelation, like I was Michelangelo there with those beans. I didn't think about it. I just started in, spreading beans around for the face, real friendly-like with all those beans. Parsley in her ear for a flower. Well, it was a carrot top. She sure looked good on the red linoleum countertop, even without a mouth. I almost gave her one, then decided she'd be better off without. So, real nice, though. Now, why would a person do something like that? I don't know. But it sure felt good, making Mrs. Peabody's face in the kitchen, right where she used to make raspberry pie. I love raspberry pie. She made the best pie. I remember her pies, Joe says. Rhubarb, sour cream, raisin, lemon meringue, apple. Did you talk to the face? Rose asks. No. Well, just a little. No one listens anymore, now that Noodles is gone, Joe says, as he rolls a green leaf between his fingers. No offense, Rose, but Noodles could really listen. I sense the presence of the Dalai Lama right here beside us, Rose says. Om, om, om. She chants, settling back in her chair and closing her eyes. The only sound is Rose's quiet chanting and the cricket and the frogs. Rose sits upright and opens her eyes wide. Joe wonders if she was half asleep or just in her other world again. Noodles could be the next reincarnation. He could be the next Dalai Lama, she says. He could be the next Mrs. Peabody, Mr. Peabody adds. He could be the next anyone. He could be the next me, or even the next you. Could I be the next Noodles? Peabody asks. If you really want, Rose says seriously. Om, om. She continues with her chanting. Mary protect us, Joe adds, crossing himself. I sure could go for a piece of rhubarb pie and a cup of coffee, right here under the tree. Don't that sound good, Joe? Rose? It does. So did that bean face send you any messages? Well, it was like a Ouija board, in a manner of speaking. No, but I knew I was supposed to make everything shine. It was like those little pimentos came right up out of their sockets and said, Mr. Peabody, you clean up this mess. And I did, the very next day, clean as a whistle. Funny how things work out. Mostly we just sit in the dark. Just lucky we have a candle. And my beans. And we had Noodles, Rose adds. She leans down to put out the candle. Bedtime. Tomorrow's another day. Joe and Mr. Peabody dawdle through the yard as Rose enters the back door. Tomorrow's another beer, Joe says. Tomorrow's another bean, Mr. Peabody adds, chuckling to himself for being so clever. He shuffles through the gate to his yard, ready to raid the refrigerator. Joe stands alone on the back porch, and looks up at the stars, thinking of Noodles and of the kindness of dogs. The end.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. 'Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. You can do what you want. The opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true. And you can make it undo. You see, ah, it's easy. Ah, you only need to know. Well, if you want to say yes, say yes. And if you want to say no, say no. 'Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. And if you want to be me, be me. And if you want to be you, be you. 'Cause there's a million things to do, you know that there are. You can do what you want. The opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true. And you can make it undo. You see, ah, it's easy. Ah, you only know. Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be. You know that there are, 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 you know that there are.
The stove. That was the summer Susan's mother made me eat beets, and I don't think it ever rained. The sunny days were endless. Each day brought new adventures. It was the first summer I stayed at Susan's folks' summer home up near Red Lake. I was 10. It was the week before the county fair, and we decided to venture into the woods. We had gone to the woods before, this time we got temporarily lost and had some trouble with wild cows. This time, we left just after lunch, which luckily included no beets, but instead delicious sweet corn and wild rice. We dug out a cherry popsicle to eat along the way, breaking it into two on the porch railing. By the time we got to the railroad tracks, my half was deliciously slurpy and drippy, but Susan's fell off to the ants. We started off along the tracks, chewing on popsicle sticks. Train tracks made a very pleasant trail, and since they looked like they went on forever, they slowed us down to a lazy summer pace, even if we were in a hurry to get to the woods. Susan walks ahead of me between the tracks, and I walk along the rail, practicing my balance technique for when I join the circus. Every now and then she hops. We are inspired to sing, but I only hum, while Susan sings opera. I don't know how she does that. I've tried, but I don't have the talent. I'm not jealous, though, because I can climb trees. I have balance and a true desire to walk the high wire in a circus. Maybe someday. Today I'll follow my opera-singing friend along the railroad tracks of our childhood. We note butterflies in the fields, but have been ignoring them for the moment. Lepidoptera is the study of butterflies and moths. We consider ourselves lepidopterists, and we have quite a nice collection. The monarch, its cousin the viceroy, the majestic swallowtail, In the dark, lonely morning cloak, several sulfurs and my favorite, a small blue-purple moth from the carrot patch. We both want a bird moth, one of those giant moths with huge spots that look like eyes and scare off birds who think they're owls. The way you catch them is to sneak up close, throw your sweater on top. Then, if you've got it, wrap it carefully, take it home to put in a mason jar. For a bird moth, you might want a pickle jar. Get a cotton ball that you've soaked in fingernail polish remover, drop it in the jar. The butterfly will die, and you can pin it on a board. Do the pinning before it gets stiff so the wings can be spread. You have to ignore your feelings when you kill it, or you won't be able to do it. It's our greediness for their beauty that makes us overlook their death. Or perhaps we simply have no concept of death yet. The train tunnel is just ahead. We veer off into the woods and snap our popsicle sticks like wishbones. We each win. This is quite an easy forest to get through because there's not too much brambly underbrush. We try to walk like Indians, which means no stepping on sticks or anything that would crack and startle animals. This would be easier in moccasins, but we only have tennis shoes. Although my ancestors are Norwegian, I've considered myself an Indian since second grade and wear headbands and a red corduroy jacket with a tie belt like a young Indian in my brother's comic book. The days my mother washes my red jacket, I feel incomplete, so getting it back freshly laundered is always a relief. The very word Apache thrills me. We walk among the silent trees as if we live here, and soon it becomes our native land. The sun shines down through the trees in great bands of light, which we step into to feel the sun. We just stand there. Particles of dust spiral downward like stars in the light, making us dizzy, and we start spinning in circles like young Sufis. And Susan sings a low and serious song until we get so dizzy we collapse into the mossy forest floor, breathless, and watch the trees spin above us while we come back to earth. I lean against a mossy fallen birch tree till I am nose to nose with a slippery, smooth orange toadstool with delicate white gills. I close my eyes and imagine what it would be like to have an orange mushroom for a nose, and inhale deeply through my delicate white gills. I open my eyes and Susan is Groucho Marx, raising and lowering thick, bushy eyebrows she's made from witch's moss. This droopy moss grows on the old dead pine branches, looks like the hair in my grandfather's ears. We like to think this forest is full of grandfathers and Indians, also bears, wolves, deer, and moose. Susan's father believes these woods will always survive, and there will never be a McDonald's or an Arby's due to the mosquitoes. Her father is a kind man, tall as a tree, with a voice like the forest, and we believe everything he tells us. He knows every tree there is, as he is a forester, and his company makes high-quality toilet paper and other products that are made from trees. We get up and move along in our own scientific manner, stuffing bits of moss into our pockets, poking at bubbles of sap on the pine trunks as we mosey along. We get sticky fingers, but smell wonderful. I am picking semi-hardened bits of the crystallized sap when Susan grabs my arm. She points. Ahead is a cabin. We stand transfixed, looking at the little tar paper house just ahead. We wait. Nothing happens. No one comes out. We move closer and continue to wait. Susan says this must be old John the lumberjack's place at the end of the unused road, and we've come upon it from the other side. The dirt road is where she came with her dad once, and she spots it near a clump of cedars, only partly still looking like a road, and mostly overgrown, with grass growing in its center. You would have to know it's there in order to find it. The quiet here is noticeable, even though the birds are singing and a chipmunk is chattering at us. We walk up to the little house, and Susan, who is much braver than I am, steps right up onto the wooden steps and knocks on the door. The sound of the knocking scares us both, and we run back behind the pump. The door remains closed. No answer. Nothing. We take a few steps forward, and our curiosity gets us going right up to the house by the root cellar door, where we can stand high enough to peek in a window. A table, two chairs, cups, and a few dishes are on the table, and in the corner a bed. That's all we can see. The door is unlocked. It creaks as we come in. It smells like burnt wood and ashes, and something else, maybe apples. The floor is wood. Everything is wood, unpainted wood. The table, chairs, an old wooden ice box. There are wooden crates filled with firewood and newspapers. The big stove is black, and heavy cast iron pans hang from hooks on a long beam. A coffee pot sits on the stove, and a dishpan hangs from a nail. There are dirty dishes in the sink, bits of egg and something syrupy on the plate on the top of the pile. We decide to wash dishes. Susan finds a pail, and we go outside to pump for water. There's a cup hanging on a string at the pump, and we each have a drink. The water is delicious, though a bit tinny from the metal cup. It's icy cold. Maybe it's poisonous, I say, taking a long drink. Our bodies may end up at the bottom of the well. We peer into the well, and Susan says it may be fed from a spring, and that's why the water tastes so good. Inside again, we put the dishes into the cold water to soak while we have a look around. Don't touch anything, Susan says. Fleas. I touch the red wool jacket hanging by the door. Everyone has these, my dad, my brothers. I have a red and plaid black one. They're for hunting, so you don't get shot. Plus, they're warm. Susan is leaning over the bed, inspecting the pillow. We use a scouring pad on the dishes and set them on the table to dry. That's when we notice the stove is still warm. We move one of the round doors on top of the stove with a metal lifter and put in a few pieces of firewood and a crumpled paper of Dick Tracy. An overturned chair and two men facing each other in the comic starts to burn. We get the cover back on just in time to avoid the flames. The crackling sound of the fire makes us feel quite at home, capable, and in charge, and I start humming and Susan starts in with her opera. Susan, I cry out, as I have made an amazing discovery. Picking at the dirty black stove with a twig, I have uncovered a beautiful blue shiny spot. We both start scratching at the stove until we have a 50-cent-sized section of clear, shiny, royal blue enamel. We look at each other and know that we have been called here by destiny. We heat up a big pail of water on the stove and find rags and newspapers. We've read our Hans Christian Andersen, know what to do. We start cleaning the stove. We've also heard the shadow on the radio and occasionally look over our shoulder toward the door as we work. In any case, we scrub as if our lives depended on it. We work hard and seriously, getting through years of black grease and grime, working frenetically for probably 2 hours straight. Each at one end, we work toward the middle, uncovering the enamel and chrome until it looks like a bright new stove. The blue Swedish enamel hasn't a scratch, and the glistening silver chrome sets off the startling blue. By late afternoon, we have restored the antique stove to its original blue glory. We clean ourselves up and put everything away. We stand before the stove to admire our work. The formerly black, crusty stove is a gleaming blue jewel in the center of the old cabin. We've done well. We gloat and laugh at what we have done, then leave quietly and take the old road home. We never told a soul what we had done. Following summer, I again went to stay with Susan at her summer home, and we heard that old John had died that spring. People say they can still hear his dog howling outside his cabin at night. We never saw the dog and never found out what old John thought when he came home after his young cleaning ladies had paid him a visit, but I have often wondered. The end.
That was Duluth author Connie Ellis reading her story, The Stove. We began the half hour with her story, Noodles. And the interlude music was Cat Stevens with If You Want to Sing Out, sing out. Well, we have just enough time left in this half hour for me to share a reading I did some time ago, speaking of wood stoves. It's called A Fine Art, Messing About. And tune in again tomorrow to Literally from the North Shore for another story by Connie Ellis. A Fine Art, Messing About by Clinton Trowbridge.
Believe me, there is nothing half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats, says Ratty in The Wind in the Willows.
True enough, but what do you do in winter? In spring there is the garden, in fall the leaves, but in winter, unless you're into igloo making, futzing with the snowblower, or carving out figure eights on the pond, what is there to mess with? There are things to do, of course, but messing about doesn't actually classify as doing anything. You don't have to row or sail or paddle to be messing about in a boat. You can just be looking, or standing, or walking, or lying down in the vicinity. Messing about is a fussy, loving occupation, indulged in mostly for its own sake. Fixing an oarlock, if you take long enough doing it and use improper tools, can be classified as messing about. Varnishing the wheel counts, though not the hatch covers. Considering, planning, investigating, these are the purest activities. But what takes the place of boats in winter? For a long time, I was sure that nothing could. But then I discovered what others have known since the days of the caveman. What you mess about with in winter is the wood stove. Consider wood. Of course, you must get it for nothing. Many people have no interest in wood, neglect it, discard it even. Develop a wood scrounging mentality, and immediately rewards come your way. An ice storm here, a tree trimming project there, and if there are woods around, there is wood aplenty. But this is all preliminary. Messing about doesn't properly begin until after you have installed your wood stove. Have you seen to the damper, adjusted the flue, closed or opened the various valves that let in the air? At what distance, if any, does one crack the loading door? Is the room too hot or too cold? You seek out various opinions. You purchase thermometers. You have cranked up the stove, a good, hot, roaring fire. The stovepipe loses its shine and throbs with heat like a city street in midsummer. Could it melt? You close off everything and gradually the crisis passes. Now you've got it. Two full turns of the bottom knob. The stove begins to come to life once more. Enough. You open the top to inspect. Smoke fills the room. You must love a wood stove. Morning is feeding time, and so is noon, and evening, and night. If the weather is bad, there are in-between meal snacks. You pamper, you coddle it. Does it have enough air? Could it be hyperventilating? You cast admiring glances. You linger in its company. Its glow must be steady, its warmth assured. You want to bask in its presence, neither roasting in too hearty a fellowship nor feeling the chill of indifference. And there is no one, really, to teach you. You must find out for yourself. If you begin to place too great a premium on pure performance, you risk everything. Impatience, neglect, ultimate fury and abandonment. You cannot sail or paddle or row a wood-burning stove, but you can mess around with it. All day and half the night, if you have a mind to. A Fine Art, Messing About by Clinton W. Trowbridge.